Let us get into the conversation we are having right now with our guest to look at what happened last night here in Baltimore. You can join the conversation at 410-319-8888 and make a pledge at the same time. We're here with Adam Jackson, CEO of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Adam, good to have you back in the studio.
Most definitely.
And Kimberly Armstrong joins us by phone. She's a community advocate, been on the show many, many times, won the Spirit of Woman Award, lost her son to gun violence in the city, has been an activist ever since, and before that even. Kimberly, good to have you back as well.
Thank you.
So let's talk about what transpired. First of all, starting, Adam, with what has happened over the last 3 or 4 days since last week around Kevin Davis's confirmation and the efforts of Baltimore Block, the coalition of forces in the city, to oppose that nomination. Could you give us a little background?
So basically what's been going on is that City Block, it's a grassroots collaborative of students in the city of Baltimore. They put out demands to the commissioner Kevin Davis and Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. The first one is what the students were talking about last night, to talk specifically about the rules of engagement for peaceful protests. And they include really basic human rights things. So so police officers not engaging in riot gear when they first get to a scene, things focusing on like making sure that there was a community liaison from the police department to the protesters. And the thing is, these are things for young people, for youth and young adults, to make sure that they can protest in the streets without being harmed. And then like 19 different points that they gave to the commissioner. What happened was that me and myself and the students met the commissioner on Sunday in a church, and he said that he was going to publicly commit to these 19 demands, and even added one. He even added a demand like, you know what, maybe we need a liaison from the police department. And so we were all really excited about it, because we were like, the police commissioner is going to commit to these things publicly. And it wasn't like anybody asked him to change policy that day. It was a public commitment. And so what ended up happening was that he did not produce that public commitment. What he did is that he put out a press release that was one sentence that said, we met and it was cool. And he lied to the students and myself. And so the students were angry yesterday, and so they decided to demonstrate. And the thing is, I think it's completely reasonable, because people are asking about why the students are mad, because he lied to their face. He said he would do something that he did not do. And I think it's completely reasonable.
So I meant to ask before we got in here, this is talking about the demands, but let me get what they were, those 19 demands. I also read that the commissioner at one point, didn't he say that some of the demands he would not, I mean, in public he said he didn't think were reasonable, but some he thought were reasonable.
Well, the thing is, and that was intentional gaslighting on his part, because he even admitted in the meeting, like, I didn't understand what some of the demands meant, and it was premature for me to say that, you know, you were saying I was going to, you were saying that, he said it was unreasonable for me to say that you were going to say we should hurt police officers, and that's not what the students were talking about. So there's 19 different ones, but the general theme of them is that police officers should leave people alone when they're peacefully protesting. And it's about not because we gave him examples like, you shouldn't use rubber bullets, you shouldn't use tear gas unless it's going to cause a loss of human life. Then you shouldn't be using these non-lethal weapons to engage peaceful protests. And so we started making distinctions. So it's like, well, okay, what is the distinction between a peaceful protester and a lawbreaker? And so if you can target lawbreakers and find people who are actually breaking the law in the middle of a peaceful protest, then you don't have to escalate the situation. And so and each of the demands talk about those things specifically, and there's too many of them to go through today. But the theme of them is to make sure that you find targeted people who are causing problems. Like during the uprisings back in April, there were plenty of people who were just there to agitate to get people arrested. And so the police department, instead of generally mounting up to arrest everybody and for mass arrest during a protest, they should have targeted people who were protesting, who were causing the problems. And that's what the students were focusing on, making sure that the students were safe and allowed to exercise their constitutional rights. And so that way they wouldn't be arrested or hurt by the police.
And Lawrence Brown's in the house as well. We'll come right to Lawrence. Good to see you, man.
Good morning.
Good morning. And let's go. Kimberly, what are your thoughts? I know you weren't part of the demonstration yesterday, because I don't think you were. Your thoughts on this as you watch it unfold?
Yeah, well, my thoughts is that, you know, listen to Adam, you know, when you have an uprising and during the uprising, it's hard to really target who is causing the problems and who is not causing the problems. And just from, you know, me as being a person looking on the outside as all this stuff started unfolding, and I'm talking about, you know, the unrest, is that it was just chaotic, you know. So I think also we have to clearly understand is that there was no protocol before, you know, all this stuff just happened. This is the first time that I've ever seen, you know, a riot to that magnitude. So I can kind of understand where the police are coming from. It's because they, it was something that it just happened. There was no preparation. And, you know, so I think there's a lot of different dynamics that are going on all at the same time, simultaneously. And from what I've seen, you know, recently with the young people, I can understand the anger, frustration, the protesting and things of that nature. But you also have to come to a point where you use your anger, but you be a little bit more strategic. Because the one thing that you don't want people to continue to say is, here we go again. Here go these young black kids that don't know how to act, this, that, and the other. You know, so, you know, it's a whole lot of things that need to be addressed and need to be done. And it's not going to happen overnight. And I really commend the young people for doing what it is that they're doing. They're really taking on a lot of things that some of the adults should have been doing, you know, beforehand and tried to do. So I just think that it's a lot.
I mean, the only thing I would add to that comment, because I do agree, some of the demands, besides how the police, in terms of how the police deal with protesters, that's a part of it. But there were other things like making sure there's one central command of the police department when there is protests happening. And he was saying, for example, during the he gave us this insight, is that during the uprisings, there were people who should not have been on the street that were calling the shots, like in terms of sergeants and lieutenants, who may not have had the emotional maturity to understand the situation and to call and be able to call certain things. So not telling police officers to come out their riot gear immediately, like a major or a captain would maybe or a person of higher rank would have had the maturity as a police officer to figure those things out. So he was like, because we didn't have that during the uprising, we didn't have the proper protocol set up, that's what caused the problem. And other things like media and legal observers not being arrested, and he was like, yeah, we should be credentializing media so that way people can be outside, like what happened during the curfew. And so that way people can do their jobs without being hindered and being arrested by police. And those are things that are regular, that should be a part of the Baltimore City Police Department's policy. And he was admitting that, you know, those things weren't in place and that it was good that we brought them up.
Well, here's the thing, is that, you know, those things happened under Commissioner Beck's administration, right? And this is what I want to say, is that, in a way, I'm glad to see that we have a commissioner that is actually from Baltimore. Because for years we have been having commissioners that Baltimore is a very, very funny place. Okay, so if you really don't know the culture and the dynamics of what we call Baltimoreans, it's hard to bring somebody from the outside in to our city and think that they are going to, they don't really understand it. They don't understand our city. They don't understand our people, our culture. I had several conversations with the former Commissioner Bielfeld, and the one thing that he always used to say is that, I come from a family of police officers, so all I know how to do is really be a police. I lived out in Baltimore County. I grew up around majority white people, so I really don't understand how to sometimes interact with Baltimore City, the African-American community. So he understood that. He understood that he didn't know a lot, but he was willing to learn. Then we brought in, we had the last commissioner who was from Chicago, I believe, Commissioner Beck.
California.
So I'm glad to really see that we have someone from Baltimore that actually has been on the police force. And I would say give the man a chance. I mean, he just got into office, and I'd rather see him in office than somebody that comes. They picking somebody from out of state who knows nothing about Baltimore.
Gentlemen, you want to jump in? Lawrence, before we go to break here.
Sure. Well, you know, the first thing I want to say is that what happened on April 27th was not a protest. That was police preemptively acting to stop what they thought was a credible memo for a gang shootout, where gang members were going to take out police, and a purge memo, which were both discredited. And so they went out and they pulled kids off the buses at Mondawmin. So that was not a protest.
Right, right.
And I think that's the thing, is that people conflate the protesting with what happened on April 27th. There was no scheduled protest. People were, the protesters were honoring the family's request to not protest on the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. And that was Freddie Gray's funeral, the day that he was laid to rest. So I think that's the first thing. And the other thing is that, you know, this commissioner has arrested Kwame Rose, who was protesting peacefully, arrested Pastor West in his church on September 9th, the day before the second hearing for the officers who were being held for the trial for killing Freddie Gray. You know, and they arrested the 16 folk that were in City Hall who were also peaceably arresting. So our First Amendment gives us the right to peaceably arrest, I mean, peaceably protest. And we're being targeted, pulled out of church, pulled out of City Hall when peaceably protesting and being arrested. So I think that's what this commissioner has done. And he has enough of a track record that I think we can call him to task on that. And I think that's what the protesters are upset about.
Let's hear a clip from the protest last night that was made by our producers, Mark Henry and Stephanie Mavronis, who were out in the streets. Stay with us. Here it is.
I think it's important to stand in solidarity with black people, you know, and it's important to make sure that a movement doesn't turn into a moment and that we keep that stamina going so that we can get policy passed that will make the lives of black people in America, specifically urban America, easier. A great example of a policy that's working towards protecting black lives is Ban the Box. Looking at issues like over-incarceration, right, mass incarceration, thinking about ways to fix those issues. So putting more money into Baltimore City Public Schools, investing in neighborhoods where primarily black families live, doing things like that will help to further the mission of the black community.
Back up, back up! We want freedom, freedom! Freedom.
I think education, that's the primary way to really, like, aid the people. If you go to the, like, Brooklyn, Curtis Bay, that kind of, like, those areas, like, the people are stuck there with, like, third grade reading level, which is, like, not even their fault. So then how do you expect people to be self-determinating and, like, progressing and, like, advocating for themselves? So that's why I think City Block's demand of bringing $20 million back into the city is, like, super, super great and super important, because that's, I think, where the first step needs to happen. And then, like, people trying to, like, set up charter schools so that, like, you know, all these white people moving back into, like, the city and into these neighborhoods don't even want to go to our schools and support them with their capital. So it's just, like, what the hell is going on? So that's why we're out here in the streets, because we're just, like, nobody else is going to advocate for us, so we might as well do that ourselves.
Say her name!
Say her name!
As a black, queer, young girl in Baltimore City, I am disposable, and this is the only way that I have a voice. So I am extremely fed up, and I need everyone in this circle to commit and pledge right now that this will not be the end, because I do not care if you are white, I don't care if you will go home to a mansion tonight, I don't care if you are straight, I don't care if you have access to every privilege in the world. You need to fight for me, and you need to fight for my life, because without choice like this, I do not exist in this country.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom!
It is our duty to fight for our freedom!
It is our duty to win!
It is our duty to win!
We must love and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our
chains. We have nothing to lose but our
chains. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
And that was a little taste, feel of what happened yesterday evening in demonstrations that, Adam, you were in the thick of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one thing that's really inspiring about people like, student leader Michaela Gilliam Price and all the other young folks who have actually been at the forefront of this, these things going on, is that they have really specific things they want to accomplish. Because typically, I think what people tend to do, and I think there's a willful effort by the mainstream media to paint them as irrational, illogical, emotional young people who have no agenda. And people are always asking that question, like, so what's next? What's next? And to me, they came out with three demands, three very simple demands that they wanted the government to respond to, and specifically the interim commissioner and the mayor. And so with the interim commissioner, in this sense, the reason why these demonstrations keep happening is because they keep getting lied to. All they asked for was a public commitment. And the thing is, some of the other demands were things like making sure police have their name tags on at all times. Because when I was arrested last week and there were people outside trying to find out who were the officers outside, they didn't have name tags on, and they had these patches that had like the Punisher logo over top of the American flag, like a skull. And they had all these other things all these other like menacing designs on top of their Baltimore City Police officers' uniforms.
Skulls.
Yeah, and people were like, "What is that? Like, what is going on?" And he would, and when we asked him about it, he was like, "Yeah, that's unacceptable." And so it's like these are common sense things that the police department should be doing, and the young people were asking for a commitment to change these very simple things, or at least to implement and put them into Baltimore City Police Department's policy. But they don't. But he did not do it, and that's why they're mad.
So let me try. Cameron, go ahead. Then I have a question here.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that was really, really heartbreaking to hear. And I think a bigger question, and this is just not about from the police department or addressing the police department, but to society as a whole. How and why do our children in 2015 still feel like they are invisible because of their skin color? Why is it that, you know, these children feel like their needs are not being addressed and that they are can be considered a person or a whole person in the United States of America? Why do these children feel as though they are still oppressed when we say that this is the greatest country and that people can come over here and build or try to accomplish the American dream, but our children who have a birthright, who have born here, feel as though they are still stuck in 2015. That's really, really hard to hear. And my heart hurts because I have a 17-year-old daughter who has never been in trouble, who is an A student, who is about to graduate and go to college, who still feels the same way, as if she's less than. So I think that's a bigger question to society.
And picking up on that point, before we have to go to break here, I really want to rest with this for a moment. One of the ways the mainstream media played this out when it came to the commissioner being voted in by the city council, confirmed by the city council, was that there was Baltimore Block, young people who have been out in the community.
City Block and Baltimore Block.
Okay. Yeah. Two different groups.
Yeah, yeah.
And
separate but related. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And allied. When that happened, there was also stories about the mothers of sons and daughters of murdered sons and daughters who were saying they supported the commissioner because he was visiting their homes and we wanted an end to our children being killed and more police were on the street in Park Heights walking the beat. So, but I want to figure out how you bridge that gap, because to me there's not necessarily a contradiction between wanting less police violence and more police accountability and ending the violence in communities that police have to be a part of, but it's a larger question than just police. So I'm saying, so can we speak to that for a moment? This is part of the thing we see in the press is making this kind of wedge, but Adam?
Well, I think it's important you said that, because the other two demands that CityBot put forward are things that communities can use to address violence. Because the thing is, police aren't responsible for stopping violence. It is people in their community. It is our responsibility to stop violence between ourselves. But the problem is that people think it's an either or conversation. And I think the way we frame it sometimes is the pathology of black behavior. So we always are mean and violent towards each other. We always kill each other. All that same rhetoric. And I think that with City Block, for example, they're trying to preemptively talk about that discussion, because for one, they were like Paul Graziano, who's the housing commissioner in Lakeview Towers. Those people don't have heat and water, and they can't get assistance from the housing commission in Baltimore. So he needs to be fired. And the thing is, he has a pattern of negligence as housing commissioner. Even when even with that story with the Gilmore Homes woman who was sexually harassed by Baltimore City staff, and so they need to be fired. He needs to be fired, and they need to instate a new commissioner. And the second one was diverting $20 million in resources in the next fiscal year to grassroots organizations and community schools. And so but the framework of that is black folks who are poor and working class, who live in those areas, need investment. And there's a pattern of disinvestment in grassroots communities and local folks here in Baltimore. And so that's what City Block, I think, is trying to get at, is that we don't just want we're not talking about police accountability, but we're talking about investment, actual investment in the grassroots. And the problem is the mayor hasn't done that. He has a pattern of not doing
that. So Kimberly, I hear you, but we're going to take a very short break again, because this is our membership drive. I'm gonna let you pick up. So don't forget your thought, Kimberly. We're going to come right back to your thought when we come back from this break, and bring Lawrence into that as well, because I think this is, to me, the heart of the discussion that most places are not having. because you try to make this divide when there isn't a divide and figure out how we come together to get things done in this community that we need. Kimberly, you were going to say what? To the question we're wrestling with these kind of people trying to make the struggles exclusive of one another around police accountability on the one hand and on the other hand community dealing violence. With the violence in communities. So what were you about to say?
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, Adam is exactly right. There is no if or and, or we should be talking about these separately. We should be talking about them, in conjunction with one another. But I also wanted to piggyback when he was talking about the investment. There's a lot of money in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. But what I've seen, and, you know, Mark, we've had conversations around these issues for years, mm-hmm. right? It's that Baltimore first is very segregated, even though it's a diverse city, it's very segregated, number one. Number two is that we need to follow the money because there's a lot of money in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. However, I see that people that are getting the money maybe should not be getting as much money, and the wealth and the money and the investments need to be divided. They need to be equal, and they're not. Most of these big nonprofits, mm-hmm. The executive directors make six figures, and you never ever see them in the community, but yet they want the people who are in the community that actually doing the work, they want them to volunteer or they pay them minimum wage. So there's a great disconnect in that, in the wealth. So if you really want to bridge the gap, then you need to support the people financially who are actually out in the community, quote unquote, doing the grassroots work. Because at the end of the day, Bank of America and BG&E, they want some money. They mm-hmm. don't want me to give them a voucher that says, here's how many volunteer hours that I had to commit in the community to stop somebody from riding or being in a youth program. You know, so we need to have, Mark, you need to do just a whole show just around that and following the money. That's one of the ways that we can bridge the gap. Because there's a lot of hostility in Baltimore around some of these nonprofits that get a lot of money to keep saying that they're saving us and they're mm-hmm, investing mm-hmm. in doing all these programs. But yet you can't see where, you can't see it. I can't see it.
Mm-hmm. 410-319. Oh, no, what am I saying? Adam, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just wanted to respond. I think you're absolutely right. I think that most of the time when you talk about investments, the community isn't even getting an opportunity to fix its own problems. And I think that the presumption is that police are there to actually stop violence or to figure out ways to make the community better, when in reality, it is our responsibility to do so. And so what we should be given the opportunity to do, and this is what City Block is echoing, is that it needs to be investment in organizations and institutions that protect the quality of life of black people. And some people, like I heard on other radio shows this morning, is that we shouldn't, why do we think we get to tell the police how to police? And it's like, well, it's an institution that governs my life. And the thing is, public safety is a public good. It's not like insurance or a doctor. I can choose a different doctor. I can get a different insurance company. But I can't choose who polices me. If I'm in Baltimore City, I'm going to be policed by the Baltimore City Police Department. And so I should have a participation and a voice in how that department is governed and how those policies are governed. And I should also be a part of the process of figuring out how my community can address its own problems. And that's the commissioner and the mayor. So I think largely it comes down to what is the mayor and the commissioner willing to do in terms of investment and making sure that we take proactive measures to protect people as opposed to reactive measures and investment in people who aren't of and from our communities.
So a question, I'm curious, you know, as we push this discussion that way a little further is, I mean, we live in silos in this world a lot, mm-hmm. right? And there's this academic silo. Not that you're out there in the community a lot doing work, Lawrence, but there's an academic silo. There's sometimes an activist silo that gets divided between different groups. Until I walked in there, I forgot that Be More Block and City Block were actually different organizations, mm-hmm. right? So, and then you got folks like in Kimberly Armstrong, or Clayton Guyton, or a dozen other people I can mention who are actively in the community working every day to end violence, secure people housing, mm-hmm. to deal with the issues that people face every day and to fight the system to get what people need, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, how does that come together? You know, on the one hand, taking it to the street is absolutely critical to kind of, or we wouldn't even be getting the attention or the differences would be made in this community if you weren't in the street, weren't in the balcony at City Hall, demanding mm-hmm. these changes. I mean, that's part of what's happening, right? But you also wouldn't get it without the Kimberly Armstrongs and, mm-hmm. and Clayton Guyton who are out there every day fighting the system and organizing people in the street. How do you marry that for strength to make change? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. How does that happen?
You have to have, first of all, Mark, you have to have the will, number one. Number two is that you have to have a commitment to do so. You have, see, we talk a whole lot, mm-hmm. but we don't do a whole lot, mm-hmm. right? So you hear a lot of people say that the Kimberly Armstrongs, the Clayton Guyton's, the David Millers, the Cameron Miles's of the community, they will, you know, I appreciate what you do and handshake you and, mm-hmm. and give you a little pat on the back. But at the same time, they don't want to cut a check.
Exactly.
But someone, quote unquote, what they want to, you want to talk about academia. If you don't have a PhD,
right.
they don't think you're as valuable or as educated, mm-hmm. which is not really true. Cameron Miles has a bachelor's degree. David Miller has a master's in education. I have a degree. So there's an assumption because we are, quote unquote, we started in grassroots. But however, grassroots, you can only stay for a little while because at some point, that root grows into a plant. That plant turns into a tree, and those trees begin to multiply because they are bearing fruit. So with that, you need to nurture it, and it comes from it being watered. It has to have sun. It has to have all these different dynamics in order for it to be a viable tree that can produce good fruit. So there's somehow people make assumptions that because we are in the community doing the work that we shouldn't get paid for some reason. I don't know. Me and David both had to write books and go all around the country and can seem to get paid everywhere else mm-hmm. but here. But here's the thing, and I said this to the mayor, is that when you have people like myself and David and some of the other people who have left Baltimore and who no longer wants to be here or invest here, you got a serious problem. You got a real serious problem. And so, that's where a lot of us are, is because we don't see the return on our investment. And I can't continue to put my 17-year-old right. daughter's life at risk.
So the question is, again, how do we bring it together?
I mean, I actually want to echo some of her commentary.
Please do.
Because I think that coming together, like she said, coming together is a good concept. But like you said, when people walk up to me and say, LBS is so great, you know, you guys do excellent work. It's like, great. So where's that excellent check to continue this excellent work, to continue doing these excellent grassroots
exactly.
organizations?
Exactly.
It's like, cause if there's no investment, if there's no money put forth, it's all talk. And the thing is, from the city side, I think that there's a presumption that we don't want to fix our own problems. Like, I would rather not have some white-led nonprofit in my community talking about direct service. I'd rather have a Kim Armstrong. I'd rather have a Cameron Miles. I'd rather have those folks in my community doing that type of, because they're of and from Baltimore. But most of the time, I think there's this underlying presumption that, and to me, I think it's racism and white supremacy that kind of underlines it, is because when you have white nonprofits, or not even white people, white-led institutions like that come into the community, the presumption is we don't have the expertise. We don't have the resources. We don't have the people who can actually guide those institutions and do things for us. So we need other people, like white folks, to come in with their institutions and do that for us. And to me, that's the part in Baltimore. I think she's absolutely right. Lots of money flows through Baltimore through foundations and nonprofits. But the reason is because we don't actually believe that black people can fix our own problems in our own communities. And I think that's the step moving forward.
Lawrence?
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, one of the big things is that we live in an apartheid society and an apartheid city. We're in the place where apartheid was born. And so what happens is money does not go into black neighborhoods. Money goes into green line neighborhoods like Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland, Canton, Inner Harbor, Harbor East, downtown. And so that's fundamentally the structure of our city. And until we change the fact that disinvested red line black communities do not receive investment, and that is a structural function of apartheid in Baltimore, then we'll continue sort of to chase the tail. And you're saying, how can we come together? I think what we're hearing from our guest this morning is that we need investment, direct investment in our communities, and we need to end this sort of game where we're giving TIFs and pilots to Michael Beattie, and in fact, giving him that $107 million TIF stole $23 million from our children in Baltimore City public schools. And so as you have that sort of pilfering and unmitigated action by city council and the mayor to give welfare to rich folk and instill money out of the mouths of our children, I think that's the sort of thing that has to be understood, is that that's a function of apartheid.
You know, numbers mean something. And sometimes when they see things scattered and see people not seemingly engaged with one another, the powers to be don't take that as a threat or need to move it. And sometimes it does take something akin to a political threat to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's willful ignorance because, as far as I understand, a lot of people that I interact with, we are united, and there are people that have institutions and resources and people that they serve. So when people say that there's like all these silos, like every time there's a panel, there's a conversation, somebody has to be the quote unquote smart person that says there's all these silos. We got to connect these silos. It's like. The thing is, you talk about grassroots activism and organizers and policymaking. I know the people that do those things, and we all connected, and we all support each other's stuff. So when people say they don't know, it's like either it's a willful ignorance, like you're intentionally trying to ignore those folks, or you just wouldn't know. And so those folks, I'm trying to figure out how do we get you more connected to the people that are actually doing stuff. Because I've been known Kimberly Armstrong. She's been out here. I know Cameron Miles. These people do things, and I'm already connected to them. So when people say silos, like people have things that they have their lanes. Like I have public policy. That's what I focus on in my organization. City Block is a grassroots organization with students. That's what they focus on. The nonprofit industrial complex was getting in the way of investment in communities. The fact that there's this wall where people don't see who's actually doing what. And to me, it's about people's willful, it's a willful ignorance in terms of figuring out who's actually doing things. Because my thing is, if you actually want to figure out where to put your money and your resources, you're going to go out and seek them out. But people don't seek us out. They take the easy exit. They take the easy out roads and exits.
Actually, Adam, they do see us, but they are threatened by
mm-hmm.
us.
Exactly. That's exactly. The thing.
They see us because, trust me, OSI, a lot of these different foundations, they know me. Mm-hmm. They know who I am. You know, they see us. They know what we do. However, they feel threatened by us
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
they think that if they give us the same amount of money or as much money or the equal amount of money is that somehow then they will become an invisible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
then we will have, quote unquote, what they think a little more power and control over our own communities,
exactly.
children, school. So the best way to try to keep someone submissive is to try and just spoon feed them. So you give them $25,000 here,
mm-hmm.
you give them a little bit
mm-hmm.
there. So they keep coming back. You know, because when somebody gets hungry, they're going to keep going back to the source of food. Then it also goes back to you don't want to burn a hand that feeds you. So then you get people who get the $25,000. They don't want to say anything against that organization. So
mm-hmm.
they shut up. They go in the little corners. And so that's how the silo happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I have three solutions to some of what I think are some of the problems. Adam and them. Keep doing what you're doing, but also I want you to add a component where you register as many people that are 18 and over as you can, because next year is an election year. If you don't like the way city council look, change how they look.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
most people in city council have been there at least 20 years. So in 20 years, if you have not seen more progress in your city, if you've seen more digress, that means some heads need to roll,
mm-hmm.
number one. Number two is that we need to stop spending our money with people who don't like us, who don't support us, who don't trust us. We need to stop spending our money with them because guess what? My money is green just like everybody else's. If you don't support me, I won't support you. And we need to be spreading the word. So that's where the investment comes back. And also, secondly, and how we make the connection is that support people who are supporting the community. If you continue not to support me, then I will pack up, move my stuff, my children and my family, and I'll go somewhere where somebody is really supporting and investing in me and my children and my community. So we got to stop playing with people and stop talking and actually do. And the two things I know that work effectively when it comes to politicians or politicians, and that's money and votes.
Absolutely.
Lawrence?
Well, you know, we're talking about investing and making sure that people have the money. That's why we're here today, right here at WEAA. But Adam, I'll pass it on.
Oh, yeah, man.
Well, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that I actually want to agree with Ms. Armstrong, because I think that it is about, because I think for a lot of people who give money, maybe there's willful ignorance. But I do actually want to agree. They are scared of and threatened by us, because I know for us, it's like if we like think about it, if black people actually had control over their own social, political and economic destiny. That's a pretty frightening thing in a racist white supremacist society. And ultimately, when you have people who are fighting for those things and the only infrastructure they have to get resources and money is through foundations and nonprofits, like she said, you get spoon-fed, it's like a little bit here, a little bit there. And I completely 100% agree. We have to figure out ways to change our political infrastructure to do that. For me, I know for LBS, that's our focus with changing public policy in this state and in this city, because without a organization that does that, then we're not going to be able to define our public policy interests in this city. And I think other people should do the things that they're good at really well, because then when we all combine forces, then we're an unstoppable force.
4103. So I want to thank you all. Dr. Lawrence Brown, you just heard Adam Jackson, Kimberly Armstrong for these conversations. Mm-hmm. This is really important for us to have the kind of conversations at the table. We'll have more of these with a fully rounded hour coming up in the next week, so I think we have to have them.
Absolutely.
So I thank you all for being here and for all what you did down in front of City Hall. Thank you all so much.